Today on Doomed! Peter Thiel, the contrarian. On today's episode of Doomed, we will be doing a deep dive. A new book has just come out detailing the life of Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley venture capitalist, Trump backer, all around seemingly super villain, like from like a comic book-esque type guy. But we'll be diving into it all with the author of this great new book. And before we go any further, let me pull him up on the screen so I can give him a proper introduction. Here we go. One second here. Pulling up his mic. And joining me now is Max Chafkin. He's the author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel in Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power, and a features editor with Bloomberg Businessweek. Max, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Matt. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm super excited to have you because this is a big week, actually. This is the book just came out yesterday.
Yep. Yeah. It's still very fresh. So.
Wow. And you're here with me. I appreciate that.
You know, when you're working on something for so long, I was working on this for like 3.5 years, and you're just, you know, mostly all by yourself. It's such a relief and so exciting to just talk about it, have the work out in the world.
Now this is perfect, actually, because this show covers a lot of the worlds, because there's many of them that Peter Thiel exists in, whether it's the tech world, the world of right wing and conservatism, and then he's been a major figure through it all. And you know, there might be some listeners who are who are tuning in, whether on the live stream or catching the podcast after, who are thinking, you know, Peter Thiel, I'm not too familiar with this guy. I've probably heard his name, but who is Peter Thiel? And I think there's possibly no one better to answer that question right now than you.
Yeah. So you know, I'm a tech reporter. Like, that's what I've been doing for most of my career. Last 15 years, and basically, from when I got into journalism around 2005 to 2016, early 2016, what Peter Thiel was really like the most important venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. So he was a guy, he was the first investor, the first outside investor in Facebook, mentor to Mark Zuckerberg. He kind of shows up, if you've seen the movie The Social Network, he's the guy who sort of sets Mark Zuckerberg up with the deal that sets him on a collision course. With Eduardo Saverin, who was the co-founder, got pushed out. Thiel co-founded PayPal. He co-founded Palantir, and really, which is this, you know, I'm sure you're very familiar, listeners are very familiar, but I'll just say it anyway. It's a data mining defense contractor. It's now worth billions of dollars, but of course, it was a startup, 15 years ago. Anyway, he's this guy who's inside and around and basically everywhere in Silicon Valley. The sort of tech world that people talk about, the PayPal mafia, and that's this group of sort of power players, more or less led by Thiel, who work together. They support each other's companies. They move employees around. It includes Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, the YouTube guys, the Yelp guys. The list goes on and on. Now, that would all, I think, be super interesting and probably enough to like justify a book, because obviously these companies are really powerful. This is a powerful guy. We should read about him. But of course, as probably a lot of people know, in 2016, Thiel kind of shifts and stops being just this tech guy. And, in May of 2016, shows up on the delegate list for the state of California for the Republican National Convention as a Trump supporter, and then becomes a major Trump backer throughout the rest of the campaign and then into the first couple years of the presidency. And then also, same month, almost at the exact same time, is exposed and then kind of gloriously, you know, in his mind, takes credit for the destruction of Gawker Media, which, you know, was this, you know, substantial journalistic outlet, kind of probably associated with, slightly left journalism. It wasn't like overtly political or anything. But in that kind of one fell swoop, Thiel establishes himself not just as this tech guy, but as this, as you said, kind of super villain slash, if you're on the right, superhero. And because, you know, at the RNC, when he gives that speech, you know, people are talking about Gawker. They're talking about PayPal. They're talking about this. This is a guy who really, you know, who really embodies like everything that's that they like about Trumpism. And so what I want to do in this book is kind of explore that. I really think tech power is one of the most important issues that is going on right now. And I think Thiel is kind of unique in that he's both this, you know, super influential tech figure, but also somebody who really is making moves, you know, on a political level. And what I really want to do is kind of cut through, you know, all those narratives, the superhero narrative, the supervillain narrative, try to figure out like what is actually, you know, going on here.
Wow. Right. So, I mean, you basically have hit it all. That's the most perfect, concise summary. But let's now dive a little bit deeper into Peter Thiel. I guess let's start with the early years before he becomes this political figure. You know, it's amazing to me because, like, I think people don't realize, I'm jumping ahead now, but I think people don't realize, you know, when they hear about, this secret event Trump was at with Mark Zuckerberg, you know, a private dinner, and, you know, this thing and that thing. Peter, you know, oftentimes I don't think people read that, Peter Thiel was present during all this. So let's jump back into the early days of Peter Thiel. I mean, I'm assuming this is a guy who's always been sort of very controversial, even in the tech world, because, I mean, to this day, apparently, Elon Musk, who he formerly worked with, does not like, I mean, and I'm no Musk fan either, but, you know, they don't like each other, apparently. So he must have always been this this hard-headed type of guy.
Yeah, absolutely. So Thiel, I'll give you kind of the short history, kind of summarizing the early parts of the book. But, you know, he kind of had a somewhat difficult childhood, you know, bullied as a kid, parents, I think super conservative parents. They're German immigrants, evangelical Christians. He lived in South Africa, you know, under apartheid, and his father worked in, you know, the mining industry in South Africa and Southwest Africa, which, you know, basically at the time, that's Namibia now, but at the time that was like a South African colony. So, you know, he's really, you know, kind of living in this really probably pretty conservative world. And he shows up at Stanford University. Stanford is not, I don't think it's the most liberal of the elite, you know, college campus. Probably, I would say, actually one of the most conservative places. But for Peter Thiel, huge culture shock. You know, he kind of processes that as an attack against him. And he starts this right-wing newspaper called the Stanford Review. And, you know, I wouldn't be bringing any of this up. It's kind of ancient history. Stanford Review is, I think nowadays, you talk about sort of trollishness. I mean, this is kind of like classic, like we're gonna, you know, say things that are kind of borderline, you know, racist or sexist, and to try to basically get under the skin of the Stanford administration, the university administration, and show people, you know, that there's this, you know, that this isn't right, and, you know, et cetera. That matters because he starts PayPal, and PayPal is this, you know, financial services company. Lots of people probably have already used it. But the core of PayPal, these early guys were these same Stanford Review guys. It was actually like in a weird way, PayPal was a continuation of this activist political project that Thiel started at Stanford. And that's, you know, not super well known. And I think it kind of sets some of the tone for the rest of his career, because he was always a technologist, but also always, you know, this kind of hard right ideologue, and somebody who's really interested not just in, you know, making, he's super interested in making money, but also interested in putting forward this political agenda.
Right, right. You know, that's interesting you say that, because, you know, about his early life, I actually didn't know that about Peter Thiel, with the growing up in South Africa, the mining company, because, you know, he starts PayPal, and then PayPal acquires Elon Musk's payment processing startup. And doesn't Musk have like almost the exact same childhood beginnings?
Yeah, I mean, Musk, you know, there is this whole crew of South Africans who kind of made it big in Silicon Valley. I mean, you know, Musk's trajectory is a little different in the sense that, you know, he kind of ran away from home, and but yeah, no, you know, another South African, another white South African, and of course, Thiel's not South.
Didn't both their parents have like mining companies too?
You know, I think so. Well, I actually am not like totally up on the Musk family tree. I've heard there are stories, and I just don't want to like speak out of turn. Thiel's dad was a project manager for mining. And so he was kind of moving around the world working, basically in the nuclear industry. And, you know, what's super interesting about sort of doing uranium mining in South Africa in the 1970s, if you know the history, like South Africa was frantically against the will of the United Nations, like trying to get the atom bomb because they wanted to protect the regime. And so if you are sort of a manager at a uranium mining firm in South Africa, like that puts you, you know, very much on, you know, you're very bought in to that, to the apartheid system in so many different ways. And of course, this isn't Thiel. Thiel has nothing to do with this because he's a little kid. But I think it's important because I do think if you're trying to understand like where somebody's kind of sense of persecution comes from, especially somebody, you know, like him who, you know, there's no obvious reason to think he should be persecuted, you know, I think he's more likely to experience some of the stuff that happened to him as a high schooler, as an undergraduate, as kind of, you know, an attack. But you know, the other thing about it is like Thiel is just like, you know, all the background stuff is really interesting. And, you know, I think is like super important to understanding somebody like Thiel or somebody like Musk. But also like this is a guy who's just like super ambitious. And, you know, I think one thing that that I think is maybe underappreciated is that like being this provocateur, being the guy, and this was definitely true, you know, when he was in college in the 1980s, I think it's true now, being the guy who's like willing to say the crazy thing, like that is a pretty good business model in certain areas of the political spectrum. Like if you want to get a job, if you wanted to get an internship at the Reagan White House, being the kind of guy who would kind of like be on the just on the edge of respectability at Stanford, you know, that would be a good way to do it. And Thiel did get an internship at the Reagan White House. And the other thing I'll say about the kind of ambition here, you talked about Musk, you know, Peter Thiel and Musk, they started competing payments companies. They eventually merged. Musk, who was more successful with more money and, you know, a bigger reputation, ended up sort of being the senior partner of that merger. He was in charge of the company. And Thiel, Musk flies away for his honeymoon for 2 weeks, and he comes back and he's been ousted in a coup by Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel is like one of the only people that I can think of who has, you know, gone toe to toe with Elon Musk, you know, basically stabbed him in the back or even stabbed him in the face and come out of it in one piece. So like he definitely is, you know, a formidable figure because he was able to sort of best Musk, you know, navigate this company. And the guys in Silicon Valley are sharks, right? And so he was able to kind of deal with that and come out of it, you know, looking really good. And it kind of set him on this, you know, career trajectory, both, you know, to make a huge amount of money and then to acquire, you know, huge amounts of power.
Right. So he moves on from PayPal. And what is next in Peter Thiel's sights after PayPal?
So a couple of things. So PayPal had this technology that they were using to deal with money laundering. You know, it's a payments company. So, you know, security is a big deal. Thiel comes up with this idea, and honestly, you know, really smart idea, that he could sell this to the Bush administration because he sells PayPal in 2002. Remember back post 9/11, there's all of this kind of like anxiety over data mining. Did we capture enough? There were all these terrorists who were doing all these suspicious things, and the FBI missed all the facts. We gotta really do a lot of data mining. Remember, you know, there's Patriot Act. There's all this stuff going on. Thiel kind of comes up with this brilliant thing to sell, which is, hey, like I'm a Silicon Valley guy. I could do data mining. I could do your data mining. And he starts this company called Palantir, and the premise of Palantir is that they're going to like look through all this data and sort of figure out, you know, who the bad people are. Right. And it sounds pretty good. And it was very successful at first. But of course, as like civil libertarians, you know, will point out, you know, data mining can be a very slippery slope because you think it's never clear exactly what you're looking for. And you can learn a lot by looking at even a very small amount of data. So if somebody looks at your sort of Facebook traffic, they can tell, you know, not only who your friends are, but they could probably tell who you vote for, whether you're married, whether you have any pre-existing medical conditions, whether you're, what your sexuality is, you know. And so it gets pretty scary pretty quickly. And the interesting thing is Palantir basically embraces that, right? They kind of use it. And again, I mean, I think you have to respect the brilliance of it in on some level, because they sort of sold Big Brother. It wasn't like journalists said, hey, you're Big Brother, you know, no one should buy you. And they said, no, we're not Big Brother. They kind of nodded their heads and said, yeah, that's right. We are Big Brother. And the CIA invested in us, which the CIA did. And they used that to sell their service, not just to the government, but to lots of corporations, police departments, you know, and so on. So it was this kind of incredibly like devious marketing pitch. And I think that is something that is kind of like trademark Peter Thiel. Like the guy is he's a good futurist, but he's also, you know, a brilliant marketer. And, you know, like one of the things that, you know, I try to do in the book is just kind of like figure out and understand like where the marketing, you know, where does the truth begin and where, you know, where's the marketing end? Where's the truth begin? And how should, you know, regular people or whatever think through something like Palantir?
Right. Before I get further into Palantir, I actually just wanted to point out, I really think it's great that you honed in on the fact that, you know, Peter Thiel is a very smart guy. Because, you know, we're talking, you know, early on you said, you know, to the right, he's probably a superhero. To everybody else, he's a supervillain. To this audience, he's probably the supervillain, I can safely guess. But, you know, I think that's super important, especially to point out in a year, or a year, really 2 years, I would say, where, you know, conspiracy theories and people falling down rabbit holes and being brainwashed and falling for all sorts of conspiratorial things, you know, it was so big. I think that's really important to point out. Like, Peter Thiel is a guy who knows exactly what he's doing. He's a very smart guy, and everything he's doing, it's not like, oh, he's, you know, he's gonna have some come to Jesus moment later in his life and go, oh, I was wrong. No, this is who he is, and he has everything set out to, you know, all everything he does is in order to benefit him in some way, and he's a very smart guy who's planned it that way.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I mean, I think that I think that he is like you say, you know, strategically he's got a lot of smarts, and I think he's been also very successful at kind of whatever manipulating you know, both the media and not just the media, but kind of like you know, an entire universe of kind of Silicon Valley people to bring them along to his worldview. And you know, one of the things, you know, so around the same time he started Palantir, he made this investment in Facebook. And it's always one of the sort of really interesting questions, I think, to ask, you know, when you're talking about tech power or whatever, is like, well, okay, what does Mark Zuckerberg believe? You know, what is his worldview? Because it's been a little bit confusing. Remember, during the Obama years, Zuckerberg kind of made some noises, kind of styled himself as this kind of center left, you know, kind of Obama style guy. He was for, you know, DACA. He's sort of, you know, palling it up with like Cory Booker on charter schools and, you know, kind of this kind of technocratic Obama-esque liberal, right? That's kind of what he looked like. And then during Trump, he kind of starts to look like, you know, maybe a little less liberal, maybe a little bit more, you know, sympathetic to sort of Republicans and maybe a little bit more libertarian, something like that. I mean, I think, is my argument in the book, that really Zuckerberg is basically a Thielist. And his ideology is Peter Thiel's ideology. And I don't think that Peter Thiel's ideology, although it is, you know, in some ways it has like a far right or nationalist, you know, kind of Trumpist component. It's not just that. And the thing I argue in the book, and I think is like super important to understand, we're talking about not just Thiel, but a lot of these tech companies, is that it's not just, you know, it's not just like right wing. It is this idea that tech companies and a specific kind of tech company and a specific kind of tech founder, these like tech billionaires, people like Mark Zuckerberg, should do whatever it takes to get as big as possible, as quickly as possible, to accrue power as much as possible. And it's not just that Mark Zuckerberg is allowed to break the rules in this worldview. He should break the rules. They view that as almost like a badge of honor. It's like if you ignore a regulation, if you don't pay your taxes, that's good. You are doing something good for the world. And I think that is an ideology. That's not really an ideology that I think tracks totally politically, but I think it really helps explain a lot of the kind of bad behavior that we've seen, out of the tech industry over the last, 15 or 20 years. And you see it not just from, basically right-leaning CEOs. You also see it from people who otherwise kind of identify or whatever as liberals or centrists or something like that.
Right. I mean, it's right in that old school like tech startup mantra where it's like, breaks, like build fast and break stuff or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But Peter Thiel, to me, he's interesting because he has specifically you ask Mark Zuckerberg to like describe his political leaning and he probably would give you a word salad because he probably doesn't even really know how to describe it. Whereas Peter Thiel, I remember early on when I was like first discovering Peter Thiel in like the early like 2010s. I remember he was a major figure among like the libertarian movement. I remember he was a hardcore, like he had a project, the seasteading movement.
Where he wanted
to build like islands in the middle of the ocean, like that, not like actual land, like giant boats where people lived on in the middle of the the ocean, so they didn't have to listen to any country's rules. Libertarian paradise.
Yep. So no taxes. You can do all the drug experimenting you want. You can do all weird medical research. It's living the dream to a libertarian.
Right. But then this is a guy who is also running Palantir. It seems like that's the thing that's most baffling to me. Like Peter Thiel, there's no consensus with his own ideologies. He has this belief that the government is to be small and don't pay your taxes and break things and don't listen to what they tell you. Yet somehow he wants to rake in these millions and probably billions of dollars from taxpayer funds, the funded government.
Yeah, it's so funny that you're saying that. I mean, I think there is this tendency, to call him a libertarian. And he's not a libertarian, or he's not a libertarian, at least in the way I think like most people think about libertarians. I think so there are a few things about that. I mean, one is, and I talk about this in the book, I think Thiel, there are aspects of that libertarian philosophy that he likes, right? One great thing about seasteading is not paying your taxes. Peter Thiel, super into, optimizing, let's put it kindly, optimizing his, tax situation. And I think that, one thing about this, the seasteading movement, even if you don't literally want to live on an island, on a floating island paradise where you can, do all the recreational drugs you want or whatever and do medical research. Like, I don't think Peter Thiel really literally wants to do that. I think what he wants to do is, create advocacy to allow people like himself to pay lower taxes. The other thing is, I think Peter Thiel he's super interested in power. And something interesting, something big was happening right around that time, the time that you're talking about, which is that there was this, this nascent Ron Paul movement, right? It started in 2008 and then kind of grew. And then Ron Paul ran for president in 2012. And Thiel was a huge supporter of Ron Paul. He donated a lot of money to Ron Paul. And at the time, I talked to some of the people who worked on the Ron Paul campaign, people who were, kind of libertarian gadflies who were around this movement, and they were super excited about Peter Thiel. They were like, "Oh my God! Like, we found our billionaire. We got this crazy guy, Ron Paul. He's running as a libertarian. And we have this guy, Peter Thiel, who sees for seasteading. Like, this is great. This is the best thing that ever happened to us." Thiel, around that time, gave an interview that I don't think has been noticed much, but he says that, this is not about libertarians. It's about setting us up for 2016. And I think the thing that Thiel realized, and the thing that actually there are a lot of other people around Ron Paul realized, is that some of Ron Paul's support had to do with libertarianism, but some of it had to do, and I'm going to paraphrase this guy who wrote this great Ron Paul book, which I think it's called Ron Paul's Revolution. But I talked to him for the book, and he's like, you know, there were people who were supporting libertarians, but there are also people who just wanted to be with the guy who was saying the craziest thing. And that was the Ron Paul they liked. And so it was an easy jump to Donald Trump. So I think what Thiel was trying to do is not, you know, ally himself with libertarians, but to sort of put him in the center of this kind of nascent political movement. And that is the political movement of the alt-right and of Donald Trump. And of, you know, kind of, I don't quite know how we're supposed to talk about it now. It's kind of the post-Trump Trumpist party. And that is the party that Thiel is trying to lead right now. It's the party of, you know, J.D. Vance, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz. Those are all guys who Thiel has donated, you know, substantial amounts of money to. And these are the guys who are, you know, more or less like, they're not pro-insurrection. They're just kind of like insurrection. They're like okay-ish with the insurrection. They're, you know, they're not saying the election was stolen, but they have a lot of serious questions about the election. They're kind of dog whistling to the most extreme parts of the Trumpist movement. And that's Thiel's movement. And I think that is what he was doing in around the time that you're talking about, around the time he's talking about seasteading and things like that.
Right, right. The interesting thing there, I don't want to get too ahead of myself. I want to talk about where Peter Thiel's going in the future towards the end. But interesting thing there is, like, you know, Ron Paul and Donald Trump, say what you want about them, and I have said a lot. The one thing you can definitely say about them is that they do give off authenticity, whereas this slate from this new slate Peter Thiel is pushing forward, like J.D. Vance, give off quite the opposite of that.
Well, and I think you're putting your finger on something, and you kind of said it in another way when you're talking about the seasteading thing. But there is just not a lot of consistency to the worldview here beyond. I mean, I think there is one thing that's consistent, and that is the idea that tech billionaires should kind of be in charge of everything. And maybe also a second piece of consistency is being super skeptical of democracy, kind of thinking maybe democracy isn't so good. But besides that, you know, it sometimes feels like a hodgepodge of beliefs that are either designed to be provocative and kind of get people, you know, sort of like what we think of influencer behavior. And I actually think, like, thinking about him as like an influencer or something is maybe not a totally bad framework. But it's also like just ways to make money. And you know, Peter Thiel is, I think, you know, in some ways, at his core, hedge fund guy. Around that time, sort of the post PayPal time when he's investing in, you know, Facebook and starting Palantir. If you ask like a regular sort of like reader of the Wall Street Journal or somebody who reads, you know, Bloomberg, you know, where I work, who's Peter Thiel? They would say, oh, Peter Thiel, he's the most famous hedge fund manager in the world. Thiel had a hedge fund worth billions of dollars. And, you know, he kind of lost it all during the financial crisis or lost most of it. And I think that the hedge fund thing, you know, it's not about having one belief, right? It's about making a bunch of different bets. Sometimes those bets are in conflict. You know, Peter Thiel had this company, Palantir, that's trying to sell to the U.S. government. It's backed by the CIA. At the same time, he's shorting the U.S. economy. Like, that doesn't make a lot of sense unless your goal is just to make a lot of money. That isn't like, you know, quote unquote. And I don't have a problem with people shorting the U.S. economy, but it isn't like quote unquote patriotic behavior or something like that. It's totally inconsistent if you're like, oh, we need to, you know, support the U.S. And also, by the way, I'm going to bet on the decline of the U.S., which is exactly, you know, what he was doing. So I think there's a quality to it where, you know, that moral inconsistency, you know, raises real questions about, you know, is there even any kind of like greater moral philosophy behind Thiel or some of his peers? And I'm not really sure there is. And I don't even know, I'm not sure which would be better. If you're against democracy, like, that seems pretty bad. And if you have no ethos, that also, like, but I think it's worth asking.
Well, shit. I mean,
but anyway, I do think that there's a lot of work is done, especially among Thiel's supporters, to kind of make this all fit together. And, you know, it's possible it just doesn't fit together. I mean, he's talked about, you know, having this background program where he just tries to say the opposite of whatever somebody's saying. And you actually can see this sometimes where he sometimes seems to just pick the provocative thing, just, you know, for the hell of it. It's like the classic kind of, like, you know, trollish, taking the piss kind of behavior, which of course, like, works really well if you're like a right-wing student activist and is maybe like not necessarily the behavior you want in somebody who has like a huge amount of responsibility in our society.
Right. You know, I think we should go to this point now, because I think this is sort of maybe where Peter Thiel starts to get onto people's radar. And also, I guess it might be the moment where he realizes just how much he can have an effect on things directly. And also, I think it's a perfect example of basically what you pointed out earlier, where this is a guy who seems to be guided simply by what is best for him, what is something he can do for himself. And to me, this is the most perfect example of being a vengeful person. And this is what Peter Thiel did to Gawker. I mean, he basically single-handedly destroyed in my estimation, a very valuable news outlet. Sure, they were smarmy and sarcastic and you know, pushed the envelope or whatever, like a lot of other outlets in that vein do. But, you know, they were legit news, online news outlet who broke a lot of big stories. And Peter Thiel basically funded Hulk Hogan's lawsuit against them and put them out of business.
Yeah, you know, I think it's important. I think it's important to be super honest about the shortcomings of Gawker, because it wasn't perfect. And I think so Gawker in 2008 published a post. Thiel's gay. They published a post with the title "Peter Thiel's Totally Gay People." It was kind of styled as like a highbrow meditation on the closet, but really, you know, it was the first time anyone had said publicly like what his sexuality was, and he wasn't ready for that. Gawker was also, you know, and was very angry, and I think probably justifiably angry. Gawker was also, as you say, and, you know, doing incredibly important journalism, and I think they were one of the only outlets at the time that was actually writing about tech power. They were, you know, and I think that's a second reason why Thiel went after them. It's not just because of the outing. It's because they were out there, you know, day in, day out, kind of poking the bubble, saying like, you know, this guy is styling himself as a genius. He's not a genius. He just lost, you know, billions of dollars of his investors' money. That was true. That was good journalism, you know. And they did a lot of good journalism on top of, you know, some stuff that I think now a lot of journalists would you know, probably wouldn't publish that. Like, I, you know, I'm an editor now. Like, I would not have published that story today. But anyway, I bring all that up because I think even if you, I think it's possible to have a reasonable disagreement about what Gawker did. And Gawker's status. But I also think that Thiel's campaign against Gawker wasn't just about, you know, it wasn't just about an emotional response to having hurt feelings. It wasn't just about this post outing him. It was planting a flag in the ground to tell not just Gawker, but any other outlet, any other journalist, that, you know, that they should be on notice, that scrutinizing the life of a billionaire is not cool, and that it will ruin you, and not just ruin you, like cost you your job, but which of course lots of Gawker reporters, there were, you know, more than 100 reporters or something like that who lost their jobs. You know, reporters had nothing to do, of course, with this post. But it sent the publication into bankruptcy, and it sent the owner of Gawker into personal bankruptcy. And that's not just something that sends a chilling effect to anybody who wants to write about Peter Thiel, you know, somebody like me. It also sends a chilling effect to anyone who wants to write about any billionaire, because that is now a playbook that anyone can follow and certainly are following. I mean, you know, there are more pre-publication threats now than there were before. You know, I can tell you, you know, every newsroom council thinks about this now and thinks about the risk posed by picking a fight with a rich person. And I think as somebody who believes, you know, very strongly, you know, in the importance of freedom of press or whatever, I think that is really, really troubling. So yeah, and I think it's doubly troubling because Peter Thiel talks about it like it was, he says it's his greatest philanthropic act, that is something he's legitimately proud of. And I think that really is, you know, it's putting down a marker. It's saying to anyone who is listening, you know, this could happen again and good. And, you know, people keep asking me, like, are you afraid if Peter Thiel's gonna sue you or something like that? And I say, you know, yeah, but I'm like afraid that any billionaire could sue me because there's no reason. There's nothing special here about Peter Thiel. Like, it didn't cost him that much to go after Gawker, and there are lots of people with that kind of money. So,
right. I can tell you as a pro wrestling fan, when that lawsuit was going on, it was very, very troubling time. And then the second Hogan tape, unrelated to Gawker, with him being a racist, dropped. And then it made the side I was on much easier than that. But well, anyway.
You know, funny thing, Thiel is like, I think probably partly because of the Hulk Hogan thing. But he's like a pro wrestling fan. You know, he talks all the time about kayfabe. And I've found myself.
Wait, Peter Thiel's a wrestling fan?
He says. I mean, at least in the sense of.
Now
at least
really...
I know I'm making things hard for you. I know. he went to. I'm trying to think. I think he went to Robert Mercer's costume party dressed as Hulk Hogan, I believe, like right after the 2016 election. You people should check on that, but I'm pretty sure that story is true. Anyway, what I was going to say is I've often found this. You talked about Thiel as a villain at the top of this, right? And I think sometimes Thiel himself is playing that role. You know, he's playing the role of the heel. Like, and I think it's useful because that can create its own power. Like, if people are afraid of you, in the case of Gawker, right, that gives you power that you did not otherwise have. So I don't know. It's funny. He's definitely absorbed at least some of the some wrestling knowledge from the Hogan case.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I think, you know, in the era of Trump, I feel like people who are into both pro wrestling or were back in the day and are into politics now seem to have a better understanding of the dynamics of everything, because it really does seem like the modern day right is just playing up like the heel role in what would be a pro wrestling storyline.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Thiel said something very similar about that, you know, and I mean, in a different context. But yeah, I think he's somebody who has an awareness. And of course he would, because he did all kinds of outrageous stuff, you know, as a college student, you know, stuff that, you know, deliberately provocative, just stuff that's, you know, designed to, yeah, to get under people's skin. And I think, you know, his support of the alt-right, or his, you know, it's maybe dalliances with the alt-right or something like that makes more sense, is totally of a piece with that. It's like seeing these promising young troublemakers, helping them out, trying to harness their energy and using it to his advantage.
Right. So, you know, going from this conversation, I think now would be a good time to bring up, you might not have covered this in your book because it's so recent, but Peter Thiel is apparently the big money behind the rise of the new conservative YouTube, the video platform Rumble.
Yep.
And
I think I mentioned it briefly, but yeah, you're right. Happened in the last, in the last couple of months even.
Right. Now, to me, what's interesting here is, you know, and Glenn Greenwald, who is someone I have trouble with, because this is a guy who I'm sure everyone knows the story by now. This is a guy I respected, and I know that he watched me when I was on the Majority Report, when I was co-hosting with Michael Brooks. And, you know, so it's weird to see the direction he's gone in, but it's extra weird to see him talk nicely about someone like Peter Thiel. I mean, Peter Thiel, in every sense imaginable, is someone that, you know, someone like Glenn Greenwald would view as like public enemy number one. It's just so bizarre to me to see him basically talk about Thiel in a positive light. And you know, it's basically, you know, Thiel is funding this Rumble platform. He's the reason why Rumble hired all these creators and are paying them large sums of money to post exclusively to Rumble, at least for like the first 24 or 48 hours or whatever.
Right.
And Greenwald is one of those people, apparently making six figures from posting videos on Rumble. It's just so bizarre to me. So bizarre.
I mean, you know, it's tough to be canceled, right? I mean, you just you gotta take those you know, multi-hundred-thousand-dollar deals from Rumble. I have a couple of thoughts on this. I mean, you know, so Greenwald, people maybe know this, you probably know this, but I'll mention it anyway. Greenwald got wrapped up with Palantir. Early on, Palantir got caught writing this proposal or being involved in this proposal to do like an information operation against Glenn Greenwald. It's mentioned in the book where these slides, basically a sales pitch, leaked. And it was like, here's how we're going to ruin Glenn Greenwald's reputation. 5 bullet points. You know, they were trying. It was a proposal because Anonymous, you know, the hacktivist group, had gotten some documents. I think they were trying to leak them to WikiLeaks, or, you know, some kind of like weird kind of creepy corporate, you know, espionage thing aimed at Glenn Greenwald. OK, Palantir apologized. You know, as usual, probably a little bit half-heartedly, like they apologized. CEO said, "Oh, I had, you know, we never knew this was going on." Of course, the guys who did the proposal, they kept their jobs. They now have better jobs, you know, in Peter Thiel's world. But anyway, Glenn Greenwald was specifically, you know, targeted. So that is something that I think is bizarre. Although, and again, this is probably like some armchair psychology here, and you probably know better than me, but I feel like Greenwald is somebody who has that same kind of Thiel, I just want to like be under people's skin. If I'm not pissing people, you know, it's like he just gets a charge from being disagreeable. And I think there's some of that with Thiel. So it may be that. And also, right, it's hard to look down the nose at this kind of, you know, at a huge sum of money. The other thing is, So Thiel and J.D. Vance are both investors in this thing. J.D. Vance is running for Senate in Ohio. He was, you know, he worked for Peter Thiel. He was a never Trumper. And earlier this year, he, you know, he went on Sebastian Gorka's podcast. Sebastian Gorka, you know, big time Trump guy, and basically apologized. He begged forgiveness. You know, he's wrong about Trump. No longer a never Trumper. And he is also, while running for Senate with $10 million of Peter Thiel's money, which he got after, you know, making this, having this conversion, he is an investor in Rumble. And I think it kind of helps explain like what's going on with Thiel, because Thiel has sort of always has two kind of things, two projects. One project is political, which is, you know, putting forward these kind of right wing, hard right, nationalist, kind of borderline authoritarians, you know, anti-immigration, you know, anti-democracy, et cetera, and putting forward these businesses that kind of feed off of that and make money because of it. So like, obviously, Palantir does very well doing business with the U.S. government. Palantir, you know, made money, had contracts with Donald Trump's ICE. And so it's like a virtuous or a vicious cycle where the companies are feeding into the political thing, and the political thing is feeding into the companies. And I think the best analogy is basically the Koch brothers, who did a very similar thing. There's a really great book, Kochland, that I read. I think it's Christopher Leonard, but it explains this super well, where like you just have you have this political thing going on, and you have the advocacy, and they're working together. And it's just this like, you know, glorious thing where the billionaire who's doing it gets super rich while promoting, you know, a version of their ideology. And it's always hard to untangle those two things.
Right. I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I actually was, debating with Greenwald on Twitter when he announced his Rumble partnership and all the other people who were joining Rumble who just all happened to be contrarian-esque, right-leaning figures like himself, you know, and he'll point out, oh, but Tulsi Gabbard was a Democrat. Yeah, who, by the way, used her last time in the House to her last thing she did was actually try to push some random, like, anti-trans bill that had no, way to pass. Like, she was just already making the play for the right, you know, that right-wing money. And I pointed out, like, you know, listen, I don't, if Peter Thiel or any billionaire wanted to fund this, like, journalistic endeavor or whatever endeavor to center voices from across the political spectrum, like how you're selling it, then fine. If, like, you showed me, like, oh, here's, like, a far, you know, someone on, like, a socialist talker and then, like, a far-right talker and a centrist talker and these were all the... Then fine, I would believe it. But you're trying to convince me that, like, Peter Thiel is funding the voices of the voiceless? Like, no. Like, this is clearly his play at trying to push forward people who will promote his own ideological leanings.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of one of the interesting things. And this is true, of course, about money in general. But, you know, one objection I've heard, right, is like, well, you know, Peter Thiel, you know, he's hands off. He doesn't do much. You know, but kind of the beautiful thing about being Peter Thiel is you don't have to tell J.D. Vance to do something, right? Peter Thiel has kind of put it out there, basically, that he will fund people who express his beliefs, and they just come to him. And there's no, you know, there doesn't have to be some kind of great, you know, conspiracy or whatever to do it. So I mean, you know, kind of one of the amusing things to me is J.D. Vance, you know, recently came out in favor of crypto, right? He put out this big statement, you know, as a big believer in crypto, and you're kind of like, I mean, like, okay, I guess, but like, what is a right wing populist, you know, this kind of, you know, Ohio, like, nothing about that fits with the kind of J.D. Vance persona. There's nothing that Mama wants to do with crypto. At least I don't think. But
the coal miners in West Virginia are demanding their Dogecoin. They're demanding it.
But of course, there is somebody who really is adamant about the rights of crypto holders, and that's Peter Thiel. And it's one of these things where, like, that's a huge priority for the kind of Silicon Valley, right? And it's really nice to have a Senate candidate who is, you know, kind of expressing those views. And again, I don't know that Peter Thiel demanded that out of J.D. Vance. I just think, you know, once you have that money and you've sort of set up a track record of spending it, then things just kind of work out that way. It's kind of the opposite of the Gawker thing, right? It's just like sending a signal that and then watching people fall in line. And that's why I think that, you know, Thiel really has the potential to be very powerful over the next, you know, I don't know, like 4 to 8 years or something like that. Because, you know, Vance and Blake Masters, who are his two main candidates, they might not win their primaries. I think there's like a lot of reasons to doubt it. You know, Vance has not done super well in the polls. Masters, who still works for Thiel, you know, is very inexperienced politically. You know, he's a young guy. But like Thiel spending $10 million on each of their campaigns, they might win. And if they do, he will have a huge amount of control in a potentially Republican-controlled Senate after 2022. And even if they don't, this kind of Trumpist movement needs a patron. And Thiel has basically set himself up to be that guy, to be, you know, the coax to the Trump Party or the Patriot Party or whatever we want to call this kind of populist, you know, nationalist right.
Right. Now, you might know better than me, but it seems like if you are someone who enjoys libertarianism for all the reasons of avoiding paying your taxes and hiding your money from the big nanny state, crypto seems to be an area you'd be quite interested in. Has Peter Thiel backed any crypto companies?
Yeah. He's very involved in crypto companies, of course. And he's held at various times crypto. I don't know if he does now. And of course, the beautiful thing about crypto, if you're, you know, a freedom lover or just somebody who's averse to paying your taxes, Peter Thiel's both, of course. You don't necessarily have to tell anyone that you have the crypto holdings. So I don't think we really know. I will say one thing that I think is super interesting. PayPal in the early years, you know, when Thiel's running PayPal, we think of that. We think of PayPal. Oh, it's like a, you know, way to buy stuff on eBay, right? It's just like Visa for eBay. And it is that. But early on, Thiel was talking about it and talking about it openly in expressly in these very terms. He was talking about PayPal as a Swiss bank account in your pocket, as a way for people who live in repressive regimes to, you know, avoid currency controls, as something that would lead to the decline of the nation state. And like those are, that is all like very radical. And it's kind of exactly how the crypto heads talk, not all crypto heads, right? But a lot of them, you know, really buy into these exact same ideas. And I think there's definitely an ideological debt to Thiel. And of course, Thiel's not done with crypto. He's still, you know, he's still making moves. I think it's still, you know, kind of one of his big interests going forward.
Now, speaking of avoiding paying taxes, one excerpt from your book was making the rounds this last week about how Peter Thiel basically used Trump in order to preserve his wealth and avoid paying the IRS. And he was pushed a number of different things, I believe, to try to pay less in taxes. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So Thiel's a huge amount of Thiel's wealth, more than $5 billion, possibly a lot more than $5 billion, is in something called a Roth IRA. Roth IRA, it was created during the Clinton era as a kind of savings account for middle class and lower middle class people. So it was it had exceedingly low caps. You could only put in like around $2,000 a year. If you made more, I can't remember the exact amount, but it's, you know, if you made more than about 100K, you couldn't, you know, this thing is not for you. It was not intended for billionaires. Thiel figured out that startup stock, which is the stock he had in PayPal, could, you know, you can buy that for almost nothing. It's basically worthless. And also, by the way, if you're the CEO of the company, you don't necessarily have the right to set the price of the stock. But I think that there are things that you in your power to influence the price of that stock. So Thiel was able to put a huge amount of PayPal shares inside of this Roth IRA. And once it's inside of the Roth IRA, he doesn't pay any taxes. And that money has grown over the years and has gone into Palantir and Facebook and probably a bunch of other companies that, you know, that we don't know about, that we know about those three. And Thiel has made, you know, $5 billion and his tax liability on that is zero because it's all in the Roth IRA. The interesting thing about a Roth IRA is if you break the rules, if it turns out that you, were violating the income limit or there's a rule against buying stock in companies that you control, if you do that, then the whole IRA is done. You have to pay tax on the whole thing. So you violate one rule, the whole thing is kaput. And that created, as I reported in the excerpt you're talking about, which came out in Bloomberg last week, that created a lot of vulnerability for Thiel. And talking to people in his world, that then became a thing that motivated him in all sorts of ways. You know, one of which was supporting Donald Trump, one of which was acquiring citizenship in New Zealand, which he did in secret. And it came out, you know, it happened in 2012, I believe, or maybe 2011, came out years later. But, you know, it's the same kind of thing. And of course, that is totally in keeping with the kind of Thiel seasteading, you know, like having these kind of tax haven backup plans to avoid, you know, the intrusions, right, as they see it, of the federal government. So I think that's part of what explains, like, why does this gay immigrant with two Stanford degrees who's obsessed with the future back a reactionary anti-immigrant guy from a political party that is, you know, hostile in most ways to gay people, and it's because of the taxing. But I also think there is some ideological sort of alliance between Trump and Thiel in the sense that, you know, Trump's whole thing was and is, you know, being the guy who says the thing that's going to make people mad, that's going to, you know, he's going to be the one to say the racist thing and get away with it. And that is kind of like a big part of Peter Thiel's, you know, what Peter Thiel thinks is sort of wrong with the world, right? He's like one of these guys who thinks that, you know, quote unquote, political correctness is like, if he had to rank the world's problems, like that would be one of the big problems. And so I think there is like an extent to which, as different as those two men are, there are things about them where they actually were pretty, you know, kind of simpatico in a weird and totally unexpected way. So as part, I think partly this kind of classic, you know, rich guy move, and partly, you know, an ideological move.
Now, I feel like there's still so much to cover, but we can't cover it all because that people got to go check out the book. But there are just a couple more things if you have a few more minutes. I feel like we can't, you know, finish this interview, this conversation, without talking about one of the weirdest things about Peter Thiel, and this was a big story back in the day. I don't know if people who've just come, you know, become hip to who he is are aware of this, but tell me about him injecting young people's blood into his body in order to keep himself youthful.
I'm gonna start by saying I don't think it's true. I think, but I'm just, in case people don't know the conspiracy or, you know, this idea, I'll lay it out there. So Thiel's super interested in living forever. That's something he's talked about, and he's funded research into this thing called, parabiosis. Parabiosis is kind of like a fringe science that involves stitching two mice together, an old one and a young one. And there were some weird experiments that seemed to show that when you did that, the older mice would live longer. And there are these kind of fringe doctors out there who are doing plasma infusions with quote unquote young blood. So that's like, you know, if you were a rich guy, you go to this center and they give you some blood from a, you know, a strapping, I don't know, you know, 20-year-old or something. And that's supposed to make you healthier. There's not a lot of scientific, I mean, of course there's some, you know, very broad like theories on it. I don't know. It's not like, this is not something that has like a ton of basis in, you know, there's no like double blind study showing this is a good idea. Thiel did, sort of cop to, and then a journalist, you know, found this clinic where he had at least had, or somebody who worked for him at least had some contact, some exploratory contact, you know, trying to figure out if this is something they could do. I investigated this, and, you know, I talked to the clinic. I'm pretty skeptical of the claim. Like, I just think, as I said, the science just feels like it's really out there. I feel like even Peter Thiel is not crazy enough to do it. Although I totally bet he's explored it and, you know, it would be open to it. But of course it's a metaphor, and it's a very useful metaphor. And like, and that's why, you know, if people have seen the Blood Boy episode of Silicon Valley, like, right, that is why, that's why that exists, because there is something, you know, vampiric about the way that some of these companies relate to the world. And I don't know. And like I said, I think it's literally probably not true. But there is some, it may have some kind of metaphorical value.
Right. I mean, I remember just recently reading a story about how Jeff Bezos is investing in some sort of like scientific group that's working on building like a fountain of youth or something like
Well, and that is absolutely real. I mean, these guys are definitely, and Thiel is, and there's, I get into this in the book. I mean, Thiel is definitely, you know, investing back in these companies. You know, he wants to live forever. I'm not sure how much progress has really been made, and but that's certainly the ambition.
Right. Now, you know, really, like I said, so much to talk about, but let me see. Let's talk a little bit more. We just spoke about it really briefly early on, but I wanted to get a little bit more into it, is just how much Peter Thiel seemed to have been involved during the Trump administration. Like, you know, from that dinner he attended with Zuckerberg and Trump, that was secret, that, you know, it did come out last year, I believe. But no one knew the details until you spilled the beans in your book. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So I'll give you the kind of quick overview, and of course there's more, lots more detail in the book, but basically, so Thiel is the longest serving board member, you know, on Facebook. He's a mentor to Zuckerberg. And after Trump got elected, there was a lot of pressure from the right on Facebook. You know, Facebook, as I argue, and I think it's really important to remember this, despite the kind of rhetoric you hear from some on the right, you know, Ben Shapiro or whatever, like Facebook is very, or maybe Ben Shapiro is the wrong example, but you know, there's this meme that Facebook is anti-conservative. And I think that doesn't really stand up. Like, you know, conservatives do very well on Facebook, arguably, you know, maybe better than a lot of people on the left. But the right was very successful at pushing this meme that, you know, that Zuckerberg was too left and that he needed to like kind of help the right. And Trump was, you know, hammering all the tech companies, and in particular Facebook. And Thiel kind of steps in as this power broker, as the guy who can, first of all, put Mark Zuckerberg and Donald Trump in the room together, as somebody who can get Mark Zuckerberg to, you know, maybe go a little easier on some of these conservative figures. And you see, if you look at like the top stories, the top highest performing stories on Facebook for a long time, for years, you know, it would be like 5 Dan Bonginos, you know, 3 Ben Shapiros, 1 Fox News, and like a cute animal, right? It's right. It's like entirely right leaning. And I think to some extent that is Thiel's influence. There is this dinner, as you said, during which, you know, as I report in the book, Thiel told, you know, a colleague that, you know, there had been a deal reached between Zuckerberg and Trump where Zuckerberg was going to kind of promote, you know, do more to promote these, you know, right media outlets, or maybe promote is the wrong word, but not rein them in. And I think there's been a lot of reporting. So that's new. But there's also been a lot of reporting to show that Facebook, you know, from BuzzFeed and others, to show that Facebook was, you know, really kind of favoring certain outlets. And so I think, you know, that is, I think it's really interesting. And I think it also just raises a lot of questions because, you know, Zuckerberg is like the, you know, he's like the dictator of Facebook. He has super voting shares. Peter Thiel has a lot of influence over, but Zuckerberg can do whatever he wants with that company, you know, with very few limits, you know, beyond legal limits and things like that. And the fact that he has this level of control over it, over what everybody, what 3 billion people in the world experience, and the fact that this guy, you know, Peter Thiel has such a profound influence on his ideology. Like, I think it's really worth trying to understand, you know, what Zuckerberg's ideology is, what Thiel's ideology is, because they are in a lot of ways, like, you know, setting the agenda. I mean, if in some ways, you know, Zuckerberg is more powerful than any world leader. And yet I think a lot of people just really don't understand like how he thinks about the world. And so like that's kind of like why part of the reason I wrote the book, because I just think, you know, we really need to understand these people and understand, you know, what they want and how they think. And that'll help us figure out how to deal with them.
Right. And so to close things out with our conversation, what's next for Peter Thiel? Like, we discussed those you named a few candidates he's backing, but that seems sort of, I don't know, like very entry level for Peter Thiel. Like, I feel like he's got, like, that's just what he's putting forward to play like the game that needs to be played. I feel like there's got to be something working in the background.
I'm sure there is. I think there were, you know, at Post Gawker, there were people in Thiel's camp who were trying to urge him to like do another, you know, it's like, you know, what's next? Like, what's going to be the next kind of like crazy supervillain thing we're going to do? And as I understand it, there wasn't like another conspiracy, although, you know, it's possible that I'll be surprised. That said, I think there are a couple of things going on that are sort of worthy of note. So one is Thiel has kind of made it his mission to go after Google. And this is kind of, you know, what is kind of inside baseball, maybe, but you're seeing this kind of concerted effort. If Thiel is another, you know, sort of what is the next target after Gawker, I would say it's Google, because Thiel has in all sorts of ways, both, you know, through Trump, both through his own comments and both through some of these candidates that he's backing, you know, put the company and through some kind of internal activism where these conservative activists within Google are sort of, you know, causing trouble for the company and getting some support or at least encouragement from Thiel. Thiel gave a speech a couple years ago where he accused Google's management of conspiring with the Chinese government, you know, without any kind of substance, said the CIA should investigate them, which is like, I mean, like, I don't know, like, you know, and he not only said that, he said they should do it in a not gentle manner, which, like, if you know anything about, like, the history of the CIA, is like, it's kind of like saying, oh, we should, you know, torture the Google executives. Is that the implication? Like, and I'm sure he was sort of being glib, but it was just like planting this huge flag saying, like, you know, government, Trump, investigate these guys. And I think like that has a couple purposes, one of which is to take some heat off of Facebook to help Facebook. But I do think you shouldn't underestimate these candidates as he's backing. And I mean, like I said, yeah, it seems small time, but Thiel has, you know, if they won, which again, no sure thing, the Republicans probably control the Senate and there would be four senators, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, Vance, and Masters, who would kind of owe a huge part of their careers to Thiel, where Thiel would be the main factor. And four U.S. senators, you know, in a tight, you know, whatever, in a Senate that's pretty narrowly controlled, is a huge amount of power. Especially, you know, if the Republicans control it, right? Those guys on the right are going to have a ton of power because they're going to be the ones who say, no, you can't compromise. Like, you know, we're going to walk away. So I don't know. I think he could end up with more power, you know, in 2022 or 2024 than he had even in 2016. And these tech companies, you know, they're not getting any smaller. You know, Facebook's reputation has suffered a lot over the last 4 years. The company's market capitalization has grown immensely. It's no less powerful than it was. It's more powerful. So Thiel, you know, it's like, I think to some extent he's like, you know, whatever, lulling people to sleep. People think he's out of the game, but he's not out of the game.
I think that's a great way to really, you know, leave people to because, you know, I think a lot of people hear all these things about Facebook and it just piles on and piles on. But I think this is something that really stands out. The fact that this guy is still so heavily involved, and not just involved with like the company, like he's someone who maybe some like high up executive is like pals with or something, which would be problematic in its own right. But this is a guy who's hanging out with Mark Zuckerberg and attending dinner parties with him, private dinner parties with him and the president of the United States. I mean, this is problematic if you ask me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really worth, and I, you know, and this is something like, you know, my book is not, you know, it's I try to be, you know, whatever, pretty down the middle. I think this is something that everyone, not just, I think obviously people on the left are outraged, rightly, but I think it's something that everybody should be paying attention to. And like the power of these tech companies, it does have a political dimension to it, but it's not only political. It you know, this kind of sense that that a handful of companies control a huge amount of our information ecosystem, like that crosses political lines, and that's something that like everyone should care about, and you know, whatever, including your, you know, conservative friends or whatever.
Right. Max Chafkin, thank you so much for joining me tonight. This was really a great discussion. Everyone should check out his new book, The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. It just came out yesterday, if you're listening to the podcast, which comes out after. Just came out this past Tuesday, September 21st. So this is hot off the presses. It is now in bookstores and wherever you buy your books online. Go check it out. Is there anything else you want to tell people about where they can find you online, anything like that?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I mean, it's my handle is @Chafkin, Chafkin. You know, totally happy to engage, you know, or whatever. Feel free to hit me up or if you have questions or things like that. And yeah, definitely check out the book. I'm really proud of it, and I think people are really going to like it.
Thanks so much. Have a great night, Max. Take care.
Thanks, Matt. It was really a pleasure.
Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, one second. Let me just log. Here we go. Oh, that was really fascinating. I mean, I've you know, Peter Thiel is someone who is I've kept tabs on for a while now, but he's never really been you know, the center of my own personal, you know, research and work and reporting. So it was really fascinating to learn more about him from Max, who clearly has dove into Peter Thiel's life, perhaps more so than anyone. I mean, this is, I didn't know that about his early life, and I didn't know quite, you know, everything he was doing during the era of him sort of, dabbling in Ron Paul revolutionism. So it was really fascinating to me. So definitely check that book out, The Contrarian. Folks, we're going to go to the second half of the show. If you are watching live, you can stick around. For everyone else, you should, if you want to access that show, you should go to patreon.com/mattbinder and support this show if you can. A Patreon subscription helps keep this show going. If you missed last week's show, YouTube has demonetized my channel. I am working on getting it remonetized, but as of right now, it is still demonetized, which means I am not getting a revenue cut from any of my videos that the YouTube ads play on. Most importantly, and what affects me the most, is that you cannot leave me a super chat right now. Super chats are turned off on my channel until this issue is fixed. Not by my choice, by the way. So you will, if you want to support this show and you would usually drop a super chat, what you need to do is go to patreon.com/mattbinder and subscribe if you can. And I made this call for subscribers due to the demonetization last week. And, a lot of you, did, want to help this show during its time of need. And those people who became patrons since last week's show, I will name them right now as the thank you. They are Nick J, Anthony C, Charles R, Chris, David T, Eric, Nick, Steve, Nicholas. Oh, a lot of first names. People who just go by their first names, I should say. Denise P, Celeste R, Shmoo, which is, I love that name. I don't know if that's your real name, but I love it. Christy S, Ben W, Perpetual Work in Progress, Awesome Possum Blossom, love that. Cameron and Alan B. Thank you all so much for supporting this show and subscribing to our patron, the Patreon at patreon.com/mattbinder. Also, if you're a podcast person, doomedcast.com, that's where you can listen to the podcast. There's links to Apple Podcasts and wherever else you subscribe to the audio version of the show. As always, youtube.com/mattbinder, twitch.tv/mattbinder for the live streams. And uploaded videos. What else? At Matt Binder on Twitter, on Instagram. Oh, ratethispodcast.com/doomed. Go there for links on where you can give this podcast reviews, the show reviews. If you can leave an Apple Podcast review, that would be great. We were doing good on the reviews, getting regular reviews coming in. But oddly enough, we haven't received a single written review for the month of September, which is not what usually happens. Maybe people have been busy with summer ending, back to school. I get it. So if you're that one individual who summer never ends and there is no going back to school, maybe you could take a minute to leave a leave a review at Apple Podcasts. What else? I think that's all the, you know, the housekeeping, house cleaning, whatever it's called. On the second half of the show, we got some clips to play. I'll open the phone lines, go to Skype, sign into your Skype, and search Doomed Live. Call there. I'll take a call or two. We did a Wednesday show this week because I really wanted to talk to Max. And this is the week his book comes out. So he's doing the interviews, the tours, you know, he's booked. He couldn't do the show on the usual Thursday night. He had a book event to do. So I moved the show to Wednesday. This is not the new night. I know last week we did Wednesday as well because it was my significant other's birthday on this past Thursday. Wednesday is not the new night, but when we got to move things around, Wednesday works sometimes. I did say we were going to watch a movie, but we didn't do that this week because the movie we were going to watch together on the live stream coincides with a guest I want to bring on the show to discuss that movie. And obviously things got moved around. We will watch that movie and I will reschedule that guest. I'm not going to give any more details. It'll be fun to be surprised about what it's about. It's about a specific conspiracy theory. So also I'm still working out the scheduling details, so I don't want to give hope where things might be pushed back again. Who knows? But working on it. It's going to be a great show. And if it doesn't happen, whatever in its place will be a great show, just like this week was a great show. So folks, stick around for the second half of the show. Patreon.com/Matt Binder. If you can support this show financially. Other than that, if you are not sticking around, I will see you next time on Doomed.